This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. I'm here in our Lexington, Kentucky studio, and I would like to welcome all of you listening throughout North America, joining us on Sirius 220, XM 206, and to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to benefit the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. Now, the PDJF provides financial support for some 60 jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Now, please show your support. Visit pdjf.org for more information. Now, our guest this evening has an impressively long list of accomplishments. He won the 1989 Eclipse Award for Outstanding Apprentice, the Mike Venezia Memorial Award twice, the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award. He has 3,441 wins to his name and over $109 million in earnings. Those numbers just keep on growing. Jockey Mike Luzzi, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Kristen. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, Mike. And I got to start off by saying that we spoke with your son, Lane, a few months ago. And let me just start off by saying you should be so proud. What such a determined young man. Well spoken. It was a great hour we spent with him. But give us an update. Unfortunately, he was involved in a spill at Gulfstream Park a couple weeks ago, I guess it was now. How is he doing?
Lane, we're actually all in Saratoga right now, where he had a little surgery after the fall, and the doctor checked it out today. And maybe a week or so, he can start getting on horses. It's been a thrill before the spill, as they say.
Oh yeah.
Lane started his career in December, and it was a pretty fun ride there for a while. And he moved his tack from Maryland to Gulfstream. He was only there not even a week. And he went some races right away. And he just had one of those unfortunate situations where he clipped heels and fell. And it could have been worse. He fell pretty hard. And the only result was the collarbone breaking.
Were you watching the race, Mike?
I was. And it's... like I said, it's so unusual, and I was actually in the jocks room at Belmont Park, and I was dressed and ready. I watched every one of his races. I didn't miss a race.
Wow.
And I thought I'd miss a race by me having to go ride a race. So there was 14 minutes to post to, I forget what race of the day it was for us, maybe the second or third. So I'm watching Lane's race, and had to go to the paddock, and he fell, and I, not knowing what happened, I had to go ride a race.
Oh my gosh.
And I got to the paddock and got my instructions and so forth, and I had to walk at Belmont. You got to walk past where the jockeys come out of to get to the track, and I saw my valet, and they said Lane's up, and he was up and walking, and walked back to the jock's room. So I knew that he was okay for the most part by the time I was going in the gate. So it's an unusual situation. Not every jockey has done that ride. So it was strange for me, at least.
I can't imagine, Mike, that feeling. You had to be just so concerned. And yet at the same time, you have to focus on your own race. You're going into the gate, but at least, like you said, at least you knew he was up and walking again by the time he got to the gate. But that's just, when he first announced that he wanted to ride, were you worried from the beginning?
I knew he had it, he was always with, he grew up in the jocks rooms between all the New York tracks. And he ventured into sports very, 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 very athletic. He was one of those kids that just was good at whatever he did. I was one of those kids that had to practice, and to get good. Lane just picked up a ball and picked up a stick or whatever it was. So we had him in Catholic school, and he was a wrestler like a lot of jockeys were. Mm-hmm. And he was on varsity, of course. And we were coming home from practice one day, and he said, "Dad, I gotta talk to you about something." He had fiddled around the backside, walking hot and so forth. Mm-hmm. But he said, "Dad, I want to be a jockey. I want to be a rider." And this was in the middle of his 10th grade year. So, and he was serious, and he was man enough to talk to me like a man. And I asked him, "Are you sure?" So we did all that. So I said, "Lane, the only thing is, I want you to finish school and get your high school diploma." I wanted him to grow up as well and experience things that teenagers should, I guess.
Right.
But part of the deal was we took him out of the Catholic school. We sent him to the public school right outside of Belmont Park's back gate, Fall Park Memorial. And he started getting on horses. And his 11th and 12th grade years in school, he would gallop horses in the morning, then walk across the street to school.
Wow.
And he was dedicated enough. He got straight A's, and he learned how to gallop and learned how to breathe. And he actually worked for some really good outfits, Joe Sharp. And Abigail Adsit was his first job. And then he went to work for Karen McLaughlin, and it was all history after that. So he was dedicated then, and he still is now, and he's on the bench now. And, it was a learning experience, but he's just as dedicated now. He wants to get back riding.
You know that feeling, Mike, what it's like to be on the bench chomping at the bit, right?
Yeah, all too well. You've said a few things at the beginning there as far as accomplishments, but some of my best accomplishments have been getting back in the tack. Mm. I've had some pretty bad injuries, and my most recent one was the worst, where I was out for 10 months. And the whole time you're hurt, all you can think about is getting back to riding. And, my last injury there was some doubt there for a while, and that was worse than being hurt knowing you're going to get back. It was mm-hmm. being hurt and thinking you may never get back to riding was my worst situation.
Yeah, that can't be a good feeling, Mike. Now, before we get into how we usually do the show, we start out with the beginning, how it all got started. But before we do that, let's touch on that horrific paddock incident that you're referring to, and tell us about what happened there.
It was November, day after the Breeders' Cup, 2014, and it was a windy day at Aqueduct, which we all know well. It's always kind of windy there. And I was riding a filly that actually became a stake horse, and she was very nervous, and it all happened so fast. Everybody thinks it's routine. You jump on the horse and you go to the track, you ride the race and so forth. But there are times when things happen in post parades and stuff like that. Well, I got a leg up, and I just barely hit the filly's back, and she flipped over and she fell right on top of me, which broke my left femur in two places. I had broken my right femur years before that. But I shattered my pelvis on the right side. It was in several different pieces. And it was touch and go there for a while. Went to Jamaica Hospital. I had a couple surgeries there. But I was bleeding internally, and they couldn't find it. And I was having, I ended up having 15 blood transfusions. But
gosh,
long story short, I got to a different hospital. I had a different surgery, and they found the bleeding and had that taken care of. And, you know, 10 and a half months after that, I was back to riding races.
Wow, I want to say you're crazy, Mike, but you're determined. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah,
I mean, the fact that you're even alive, for one thing, and to be back riding.
It was scary there for a while. I actually didn't realize, you know, I was already thinking about when can I get back to riding. And in the meantime, I was bleeding inside, and, you know, they couldn't figure out why the pain medication wasn't working and so forth. So,
goodness.
And one of the situations happened, which I wasn't aware of, you know. A priest had come in the room, and you know, I guess that's never very good when a priest comes into a patient's room.
No.
But I made it through it, and it was a tough go. I had to work very, very hard. Physical therapy was tough, and it was, you know, it wasn't easy. It wasn't. And I had other injuries where, you know, I got back to riding, but this was a lot of work.
I would say so. Being out of action for so long has to be, that's the worst part about it. I remember spill I had, and I was in a coma for a couple of days, and the second I woke up, the doctor standing by the bed, I said, "Hey, doc, when can I go back to riding? I want to ride." You know,
yeah.
That's all you think about. That's it. That's all you think about.
Absolutely.
So,
and most dedicated jockeys, you know, I've seen kids fall and never ride another race, you know,
right.
You know, I've seen some of my friends' careers end with injuries. So I've seen a lot, and I can only talk about myself. I've always wanted to get back to riding, and, you know, was never afraid to get back to riding. It's what I am. It's what I do. And I wasn't finished yet, so I wanted to make sure of that.
Still not finished yet, Mike. Now tell the audience, if you can describe, I don't even know how you can really, but what is it about riding that you just can't wait to get back for, even when you go through all these horrific injuries? What is it that makes you keep wanting to go back for more?
Well, I can speak for myself, and you know, I've always had goals. I mean, since I was an apprentice and not even riding races yet, you know, the Eclipse Award was a goal of mine as to be a leading apprentice. There's still things that I haven't done yet, and I love race riding. And ask any of my colleagues. I've ridden with Jerry Bailey to now. We've got the Ortiz kids. I've ridden with Santos, who I saw this morning, and even Jacinto Vasquez. And if you ask any of them, you know, who loves riding races more than anybody, and they, you know, 9 or 10 of them might say my name.
Mm-hmm.
I love everything about it. I love the competition. I love to win. I wasn't the best loser early on in my career, and I had to learn to be a good loser. And that's a very important aspect of being a jockey is learning how to lose, learning to blame yourself. You can't always blame other jockeys or your horse. You know, you make mistakes, and I always was a student of the game, and I analyze races all the time. And, you know, throughout the years, I've had people come to me for advice, you know, and even now, the kids in New York and so forth, you know, they kind of took to my style of finishing on a horse. I mean, there's a few guys that every once in a while I look up, and I think it's me 10 years ago or whatever, but I love race riding and everything about it, not just the winning. You know, some guys just like the winning and they're addicted to it and so forth. I've heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually like being in a horse race.
Mike, something I respect about you so much is the fact that you said you weren't a good loser before, but I know now you're very even keel. You don't really let things get to you, and you just put your head down and you just keep going, and that's a hard thing to do in this industry. There's a lot of highs and a lot of lows, and I don't know how you do it, because that's a tough thing to do.
It is, and the injuries had a lot to do with that. And, you know, and I don't want to keep heading back to that time, but that during those 10 months, you know, I'm not a very religious person. I'm not a preacher, but I feel like I made a deal. Listen, all I want to do is get back. I'll ride 50-1 shots. I don't care. I won't get upset if I get beat in those or fight another jockey if he cuts me off or something like that. So the injuries had a lot to do with getting me to a level-headed place. You know, when I was young, I always want to fight and you know, holler and scream with the other jockeys. I think I heard you had Mark Johnson on one year, and we were actually very, very close friends.
Really?
We were kind of broke into the same mold. He was a year after I was, and, you know, Mark was kind of the same way. And we, at that time, we both kind of learned how to be professional. You know, you got to learn how to lose. And even when you win, I see some guys celebrate, and they kind of celebrate a little too much, or they want to give themselves too much credit. And, you know, first of all, we're nothing without a good horse.
Right.
And so you got to give credit to the horse first, then the trainer, then everybody that works around the horse. So you can't celebrate too much because there's 9 guys behind you that lost.
Right.
And that now they have to go explain to their trainers and their owners about, you know, why they lost. Mm. You know, so it's, to me, I don't mind a little bit of celebration. I always was taught, you know, to learn like you've been there before. You know, I've never won the Derby, but I've always pictured what I would do or what I would say if I won the Kentucky Derby. And, you know, that's a little piece of me that's inside that someday I'd love to get out.
Love it, Mike. Well, I won't ask you what that is. I'll let you save it for that opportunity.
I'm saving it.
But is that one of the things you mentioned a little bit ago, things you haven't done yet, that you still have these goals? Is winning the Kentucky Derby one of those?
Absolutely. And I'm, that's every jockey's number one goal, I'm sure, whether they admit it or not. And I always, you know, people talk about the Derby, and we're all, you know, we drive outside the gate, so to speak, and there's people, you know, at the gas station or at wherever it is in the shopping mall. They hear you're a jockey. Have you ever won the Derby? Have you ever ridden the Derby? And, you know, that's the number one goal of all jockeys. If I ever get there, I've never ridden the Derby. You know, I've ridden the Preakness and the Belmont, Breeders' Cups. I've never won a Breeders' Cup race. I've been close, and you know, the injuries have been involved in my past, so to speak. So those are always goals. I don't think I'll ever be leading rider again. I kind of, you know, not that I've given up on that, but I've accepted it. And, you know, that's for the guys that can ride 9 races a day. Like I said, you said I had 3,000 and some winners. I mean, I always wanted to get to 4. The time off with the injuries probably won't allow that. But if you don't wake up in the morning to go breeze horses or you know, I got two-year-olds to work tomorrow here at Saratoga. And, mm-hmm. You know, there's always that little thought that maybe this is the horse. So that's what keeps us going, goals like that.
That hope that maybe you're sitting on the next Triple Crown winner, whatever it might be. You know,
absolutely. And I'm sure, you know, every trainer is the same way. They're hoping the next two-year-old. That's why it's great this time of year with the two-year-olds that no one's thinking Derby, you know, outside, but inside everybody is. And that's just the nature of the game.
I love it, Mike. I love it. Now, you said you're working horses in the morning. Now, I've heard that you're a very hard worker in the mornings. Is that true? And is that something that you feel you owe a lot to your success because you work so hard in the mornings?
I mean, I've got that kind of reputation. I don't overwork. I mean, I see some riders, you know, work a lot of horses that they don't necessarily ride in races. I mean, I've been through a lot and I've accomplished a lot where basically when I'm out in the morning, I'm doing work for myself. And I'm not, you know, I don't think too highly of myself. But, you know, this is my business and you know, I wouldn't expect someone else to breeze a horse for me, you know, in a favor or something like that. But I do work hard. I'm out every morning. I'm a New York regular. I've had offers to go other places, and I never took them. And, you know, I, besides Lane, I have a daughter, LaRue, who has two more years of high school. And I live right in Fall Park. It's less than a mile from Belmont. So
oh, wow.
I do go out every morning, and I do breeze horses, but I don't overwork. Like some, like Calvin Burrell, you know, that guy would work, you know, 15 horses a morning. I could never get that many horses to work. I'm out there every day.
Now, Mike, describe to our audience, we're self-employed contractors, so basically we have to go out and seek our own business. And when you're going out in the mornings, besides working horses, you've also kind of got to sell yourself. Is that right? And describe exactly what that entails.
Well, I when I'm talking to someone who doesn't know about our business, what jockeys do, we are private contractors. You know, we work for ourselves, and we go out in the morning, we're selling ourselves, and I'm trying to convince, you know, Rudy Rodriguez or Chad Brown or whoever it is that I'm the man for the job, you know, that I'm, you know, not that I never knock other jockeys, you know, that's just the way I am, but I need to convince them that I'm the best guy for the job. And, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's, you know, you have to be social. It's a very social business. Owners want to meet the jockey and talk to the jockey. And, you know, they always don't want to meet the agent. They want to know who the jockey is, who's riding their horse, and so forth. And we all know, you know, that winning races is the best seller. And winning races yesterday is the best seller. So a lot of times, you know, it's not what your resume is. It's what it is yesterday. And it's, we all know it's a snowball effect.
That's right, Mike. You got to win to win. Jockey Mike Luzzi joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Well, Mike, like I said, let's go back a little bit, rewind a little bit back to your early days. And you grew up near Delaware Park. Tell us how it all began.
Well, I mean, to go back that far, my grandfather was a top trainer in the 60s, 70s, and I actually went a grade one for him in 1990, and that's Virgil Buddy Raines. He won the Preakness in 1962 with Greek Money. So my brother, who also was a jockey, grew up with watching, you know, my grandfather train horses. He was at Monmouth Park, and he was actually early on in the 60s at Delaware. He trained for a Brandywine stable right there at Delaware Park. So my brother had started riding races, and I was kind of not that interested early on. I kind of caught it, you know, a little bit towards the end of my high school years.
Really?
And watching my brother ride and being at Delaware Park, which was close to home there, I caught the itch, and I eventually ventured out. I went to South Carolina. I learned how to ride in Aiken, South Carolina. And my grandfather sent me to a trainer in Maryland who thought would give me a start, and that was a trainer named Eddie Gaudet, who was known for making apprentice riders in the mid-'80s, say the maybe mid-'80s to the early 90s. And I went there, and I started to work for him, and he gave me a shot to ride races, and, you know, here we are, you know, 2016, still doing it.
The rest is history, Mike. The rest is history. Tell me about watching your brother John ride. I'm assuming he was older, and did you guys learn together at the same time, and was your grandfather the person to really teach you how to sit on the back of a horse?
Interesting. I mean, we took two completely different paths. He actually had, my brother John had quit school. He is older, of course, 2 years, and he quit school when he was 16, and he ventured all over. He had a pretty good resume there. He rode all over the East Coast, and he shipped around, but he did learn from my grandfather, which I eventually did too. And it's funny, one of the first horses that I really got on, a horse named Timely Warning, when he was first gelded.
Mm.
You know, they're a little quiet then. They need exercise a couple times a day. And I was in Aiken, South Carolina, you know, I would jog him in the morning and jog him in the afternoon. I ended up winning a grade one on that same horse.
Yeah.
I win the Brooklyn Handicap at Aqueduct a few years later.
Wow.
So it was definitely influenced by my grandfather. He did teach me a lot. And, you know, he actually, it's funny, he actually knew George Wolfe and had a lot to do with the input of that movie here, Seabiscuit, a few years ago.
Really?
And, yeah, it was interesting. They had asked him for a lot of the, you know, a lot of the information for that movie, because he was like one of the last guys alive that knew of the time and knew George Wolfe, actually. So we've heard it all. I mean, Buddy was famous for his storytelling. You know, whether they were true or spiced up a little bit, only we know. So
of course.
He was a good storyteller.
Well, and then that has to be so cool, too. Then you go on to win the prestigious George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award. I mean, that's too funny. I mean, how it's a small world, boy,
yeah.
And what an honor that is.
It was, and he even mentioned that, Pop, you know, before he died. He always said that's one of the awards you need to win. You need that to win that award. And, you know, I'll say now, I didn't really know too much about that award back then. And then as the years went by, as of course, you know, all my colleagues that I got to see win it. And it's very, it's a unique award because it's voted on by your peers. And the list of names who won that award was incredible. And it was actually a great day. And I was hurt. That's when I was on the bench. And that gave me even more inspiration to get back in the saddle, winning that award.
We'll be back with jockey Mike Luzzi after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
Good evening, everyone. This is Corey Johnson with the weekly Jockey Talk 360.com update. Julian Leperoux continued his international hot riding streak with a victory in Sunday's Queen's Plate and was named the Jockey's Guild Jockey of the Week for the holiday week from June 27th to July 4th. From Royal Ascot to Churchill Downs to Woodbine, the Frenchman has been very successful all over the globe. At Woodbine, Leperoux guided longshot Sir Dudley Diggs for owners Ken and Sarah Ramsey to a half-length victory in the 157th running of the $1 million Queen's Plate. Over the last 30 days, the native of France has enjoyed, as I said, international success, really highlighted by Tepin's victory in the Queen Anne Stakes at Royal Ascot, where she bested some of Europe's top milers on June 14th. Leperu captured three stakes last week, including back-to-back added money wins at Churchill Downs on Saturday night when he won the debutante aboard Pretty City Dancer and the Bashford Manor on Classic Empire. Both two-year-olds were trained by Mark Cassie and owned by John Oxley. What a team, Leperu, Cassie, and Oxley. For the week, Leperu was the leading jockey in earnings with $750,000 from a record of 32 starts, 5 wins, 5 seconds, and 2 thirds. Leperu also had an outstanding Churchill Downs spring meeting. He ended up in second place with 42 wins. A 2-time Eclipse Award winner, Leperu is actually tied with fellow Frenchman Laurent Giroux in 2016 graded stakes wins with 15. And Leperu is ranked 6th overall with mount earnings of $6.6 million for the year in North America. Another jockey, as I mentioned earlier, Laurent Giroux had a great week. He won 3 stakes at 3 different tracks. He had a win percentage of 31%. He won a stakes race at Prairie Meadows, Parks, and then at Monmouth Park, he won the Grade 1 United Nations Stakes aboard World Appeal. Rafael Bejarano is another one who had a great week. Not only did he do really well in Southern California, as always, he traveled to Prairie Meadows, where he won the Iowa Derby aboard American Freedom. And then some other jockeys that maybe didn't hit the stakes highlight, but have some really solid weeks with 11 wins each, Antonio Gallardo, Luis Perez, and Deshaun Parker. This is Corey Johnson for the weekly edition of JockeyTalk360.com.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
And the field turns for home. The Lumber Guy and Brigand, they've been virtually together for the entire way, through 3/4 of a mile, in 1:10 flat. They're coming into the final furlong now. Brigand on the outside, the Lumber Guy at the rail. Both of them sent to the limit. And then it's Termlo back in third. Stirred Up gets on track late, final 16th. And the Lumber Guy is going to do it. The Lumber Guy running hard for a mile. In 1:36 flat, Brigand was second. Then Stirred Up, Dan and Sheila.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I am Christina McManigle, joined tonight by jockey Mike Luzzi, and what we just heard was the replay of the 2012 Jerome Stakes with Mike aboard the Lumber Guy. Mike, we're back here, and I want to talk about a different horse, actually. We just heard the replay,
sure.
But let's talk about the horse you just mentioned prior to going on the break. Timely Warning, the horse your grandfather trained and who actually you scored your first Grade 1 victory aboard. Tell us about that horse.
He was a Maryland bred. I think he was by Caveat. He was interesting, and he went to Maryland Million a few times, and he was a trainer's horse, and my grandfather was very, very sharp. And you know, he was an old timer that knew how to get a horse ready for a certain race, which is, you know, it's kind of a dying thing because of the way that horse racing is now. But he was gelded in Aiken, South Carolina, and I was just learning how to ride horses, and he was one of the horses that I learned how to ride on. And you know, when a horse gets gelded, sometimes they're not too eager to move. Mm-hmm. And I remember my grandfather, you know, we used to tease him, but he goes, I couldn't make the horse jog. He didn't feel like jogging because he was in pain or something. So they need to move to help along with the healing. So he hollered at me jokingly, how are you going to ever ride races? You can't even make this horse jog. What are you doing? You know, so he's a very, very important horse in my career and in my life as well. He was neat. He was a fun horse to ride. He won Brooklyn Handicap, beating Chief Honcho at Aqueduct, back when the Brooklyn was at Aqueduct. And I remember the race like yesterday.
Describe it to us, Mike. What exactly happened in the race?
It was my first time riding in New York. My career was in Maryland at the time. I was one of the leading riders. it was funny. I said before, Mark Johnson and Edgar Prado had came to Maryland, and the three of us had most of the business at the time. And, you know, here was my chance to go to New York and ride a Grade One race for my grandfather. He was kind of a plotter horse. And Brooklyn was, I think, was a mile. And it might have been 5/8 at that time. It was a extended race. Mm-hmm. And he broke and placed himself. And he was kind of a push-button horse who Chief Honcho, I remember, coming to me at the head of the stretch, and we pulled away from him. And that was my first Grade One.
Wow. That had to be just an incredible feeling, not only to win your first Grade One, but for your grandfather. I mean, that just had to be an incredible feeling. Do you still have, I'm sure you probably have the win picture hanging up somewhere in your house, right?
Yeah, it's around somewhere. Yeah. And I had, you know, he'd win the Maryland Million too. And I think there's a picture, I'm in Saratoga now, but the house downstate near Belmont, there's a picture in my kitchen that I'm finishing on Tommy Warren. So I think there's even a picture of me jumping off him in the winner's circle at Pimlico. So he was, like I said, he was a big part of my career early on, but the memories are still there.
That's incredible, Mike. And then to think that, you know, rewind back to when you first arrived in Maryland working for Eddie Gaudette, who I know very well. He's a legend. And
yep.
I heard that you lived in his hayloft.
I sure did. I lived in the hayloft, and you know, that you could hear the rodents running around at night, and if a horses were right below me, if a horse got cast or something, I'd you know, I was halfway the night watchman, I'd be the first one to the horse too. And I learned a lot from those experiences, and it's funny because, you know, Lane started his career in Maryland as well. Mm-hmm. And he actually rode his first race for Eddie's daughter, Lacey, which to me is incredible. You know, I was there when Lacey was born.
Wow.
Linda Gaudette was galloping horses with me, pregnant with Lacey. And now here Lane Luzzi rode his first race for Lacey Gaudette. So it's, you know how horse racing is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's incredible. What did Eddie teach you? I know, like I said, Eddie is a legend in Maryland, and I'm sure he taught you a lot. What specifically did he teach you about riding?
Exactly. There's some things I can't tell you that he taught me, but anyway. Eddie was actually a jockey himself, which some people didn't know. It was, you know, way back in the 50s or something like that. And he taught me a lot about balance. My gait skills were from Eddie directly. He would actually climb up in the gate with you, and as you were breaking a horse from the gate, he would tell you where to put your hands. And, you know, he taught me a couple other things I've never told anybody else. So I always keep that to myself and think it's an advantage. It might not be, but
don't tell your secret here. No.
That's right. That's right. I only taught I taught Lane everything he knows, but not everything I know.
No.
But Eddie was really he was a jockey at heart and mind. Even though he was a very, very, very good horseman, he always knew how to talk like a jockey. And, you know, he taught me a lot about not just riding horses, but he taught me about being a jockey.
Like I said, Eddie Gaudette is a legend. I have the utmost respect for him. And so, again, fast forward to you go from living in a hayloft to winning the Grade One Brooklyn Handicap, and you're taken off in Maryland with your apprentice, and then you end up winning the Eclipse Award for Outstanding Apprentice in 1989. But I heard that it took you 72 rides before you won your first race.
Yeah, and it was by design, and that was Eddie's doing. You know, it was one of those things you needed to learn, and you needed to learn how to lose. And I think, you know, my first win was a mistake. I don't think I was supposed to win that day, but we did, and that was on one of Eddie's horses. And everything was by design. I honestly have to say, you know, not every jockey gets the right guidance.
Yeah.
You know, I was so lucky. I was always guided correctly and in the right directions. Even my first agent was, you know, was the best. But another thing about Eddie is, you know, that the Eclipse Award was the ultimate goal. And, you know, your apprentice year starts when you win your fifth race. Mm-hmm. So I had win my fourth race in September. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was ready to leave the barn. I was still galloping horses at the barn every day. And I thought I was going to get an agent, start to branch out and so forth. Well, Eddie had a different idea. I didn't ride another race from that September till December because he didn't want me to win my fifth race before the end of the year, before 1988. So I didn't ride another race for a few months, which was really hard and was really, hard for people to understand. I was mad as heck. I mean, and Eddie went on a roll after that. His horse, all the whole barn started winning. So, but it, the reason I won the Eclipse Award that year, which was a pretty good class, was because I had my bug the whole year of 1989. I won my fifth at the end of December. So 1989, I had the whole year.
Wow, so it was all...
it was by design, and it was all guidance and all good. I was always getting good advice, and I was never, you know, steered in the wrong direction, which I always was thankful for.
But, wow, talk about patience. I don't know how you did that. You just got that, just started out, then they make you wait. They put you on the bench, but it all paid off.
It was horrible, and I'd be, you know, Eddie would make me, I'd have to hot walk the horses after the races. You know, I was in the winner's circle, and Linda reminds me, she goes, you had the worst look on your face. You were so mad, you know, and then I had to go walk the horse, cool the horse out after the race that just won, that was, you know, that I thought I'd be riding. So it was a great learning experience and great memories.
Oh, for sure, Mike. Tell us about the day you won the Eclipse Award in 1989. You said it was a good class. Who did you beat that year?
It was a great class, and it was, you know, some people to this day don't know it, and it's only, you know, a resume and so forth. But Joe Bravo, mm-hmm. Garrett Gomez, and Corey Nakatani, we all had the bug the same year.
Wow.
And matter of fact, Garrett Gomez, I was just doing okay as an apprentice because Ken DeSormo was still in Maryland at that time, and that was the year Ken almost won 600 races.
Wow.
So I was just doing okay, and then Garrett Gomez came to Maryland as a bug rider, and we rode together for 4 or 5 months. By him coming there, I took off even better than Garrett did, but it took two bug riders for it to get going, and it was very interesting. And we're still friends to this day, matter of fact.
No, but that does make sense to me, Mike, because for one thing, Maryland is a place that bug riders, apprentices do so well at, and to have two feeding off of each other with double calls, et cetera, you know, that would make sense. Who would you say was your biggest mentor during those early days as an apprentice in the jocks room?
That's very interesting. I mean, like I said, Mark Johnson came after me. Matter of fact, he got started from one of my double calls when he came. You know, I was getting ready to lose a bug, and Mark was just starting. Mm-hmm. He got going. So Mark, I was kind of like one of Mark's mentors. We actually became good friends. But at the time, Mario Pino was there, and Kent DeSormo was there.
Wow.
Kent chose to leave. That's the year he left after he won the Eclipse Award as a journeyman. Mm-hmm. And then Edgar came, and Edgar was a mentor of mine, and we're still very close friends as well. Matter of fact, when I moved to New York, me and Edgar moved to New York at the same time.
Really?
And he eventually went back. I stayed in New York.
That's what a good group in the jocks room you're describing now. That's incredible.
And there was more. I mean, there was guys. You know, Donnie Miller was there, and it was good. It was a good place to learn. And Jimmy Edwards was there. He's a steward now in New York. But Edgar and you know, Mark and Mario Pino, who's still riding, who was incredible. He just won the Nisi Award. I saw him the other day. He looks the same. So it was a good place to ride. But you learned how to ride the right way, and I think I fell into New York with no problem because I was already riding with good riders.
Oh, that has to help incredibly to watch the riders around you and to mimic maybe the riding style, things like that. How would you, Mike, how would you describe your own riding style?
My it's my peers tell me, and at that time, the Frank Lovato Equisizer was invented, and I think I owned like the third or fourth original one.
Wow.
And it helped me tremendously with my style, because, you know, like Lane learned how to ride on that thing when he was four.
Wow.
So I credit a lot to that, to my style. The kids now, the Ortizes and the Francos and so forth and so forth, they tell me I have a Spanish style of riding, that I don't look like an American rider.
Really?
They mean well. It's kind of a compliment.
Yeah.
I've managed to keep my weight. I don't have a weight problem. You know, the injuries haven't interrupted my style of riding. As far as horses, I believe I can ride any kind of horse. I can adjust to any kind of race, and I don't mind speed horses, but I like horses that come from off the pace, and I like doing it all.
Oh yeah, just give me a winner, right, Mike? That's it.
Give me something to work with. That's
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Now, Mike, you mentioned weight. You don't have a problem with your weight, and you're one of the very fortunate ones. I did, and that's not fun. And what would you say,
right,
what's your like daily routine as far as what you eat? Do you exercise, away from the track?
I do exercise. I've taken a liking to exercise. I don't eat a lot, but I even when I get hurt, I get lighter, where some guys get bigger and they blow up. I'm just naturally small. I mean, I wear a size. Me and Lane wear the same clothes. I wear a size 5 shoe.
Wow.
You know, I'm 46 years old, and I don't eat a lot. I only eat dinner. I honestly don't eat breakfast or lunch, especially during racing days. Dark days, I might have lunch or something.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't have a very big appetite. But when I'm done riding races, I'm usually hungry for dinner, and I eat what I want. You know, I don't overeat, but I eat a decent meal, and It's kept me healthy, and I see guys struggle, and I've seen it all, and I've seen guys have to stop riding because of their weight, and it's terrible. And there's been some documentaries where I've seen, and it's, you know, not everybody has a weight problem, and, you know, some people think we all do, but I've been blessed. And Joe Bravo too, he's a little guy too, so.
Oh yeah.
And but it's, we're a low percentage, but there are some of us that we're meant to be little.
That's right, Mike. What do you think about the current weight system? I know a lot of people say, oh, we should raise the weights, you know, we're all getting bigger, and what are your thoughts on that?
It's funny, I actually had that same conversation this morning with a Hall of Fame trainer, Leroy Jolly.
Oh yeah.
And back years ago, I was kind of active with the Jocks Guild. Pat Day was the president. He was little, we all know, and famous where you're at right now. And we always joked around. We didn't really mean it. But we always said, you know, keep the weights the same or make them lighter. There'll be less competition. We'd get more amount.
Oh, yeah.
It's a catch-22. If they raise the weight, you know, anybody that's heavy is only going to go up to that whatever borderline is. They're only going to be, you know, they're only going to reduce the same.
No.
There has to be a line somewhere. You have to be small. You know, it's a shame to see what people do to themselves to be small. You know, Mark Johnston, like you said, he was 5'9". He was incredible.
I don't know how he did it.
He kept himself small, and I happened to see him a couple of years ago. You wouldn't even recognize him.
Yeah. Yeah, he was in studio here. You never guess.
It's catch-22.
Yeah,
like Leroy Jolly says, he goes, you know, and now he's comparing the weights. He thinks they're they mean less now because there's no real handicap races anymore. So they could almost put their weights anywhere now, he said.
Yeah, that's a good point. But, you know, then people argue, well, track records and things like that would change, et cetera.
Right, right.
You know, and like you said, I mean, really what it comes down to is that no matter what the weights are, there's always going to be guys who are too big trying to make the weights. You know, so what do you do?
It's sad to say, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings by saying too much, but there has to be, you know, you got to be little.
Yeah. That's the bottom line, right, Mike? That's the bottom line.
Jockey
Mike Luzzi joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Now, Mike, you said previously that you're year-round and a New York rider for the most part. Since you first moved to New York back in, I guess it was 1994, what made you decide to move to New York?
I don't know. At the time, I was doing fairly well. I was winning a lot of races and you know, wanted to see more, wanted to do more, wanted to ride the better races. And not that you couldn't in Maryland, because, you know, we all seen good horses come out of Maryland and go forward and stuff like that. It was just one of those things where there was a new goal and a new adventure. And I was young. I was when I moved to New York, and it was guided, of course. Joe Berto, who was my agent at that time, didn't want to go to New York, so he sent me to a New York agent, a guy named Chuck Del Preto, and I got going right away. I mean, I took off and started winning races. I end up winning that next year. I was leading rider in New York races one.
Wow.
And everything just fell in place, and it was a new adventure. And you know, I win big races and rode some good horses, but you know, I never got to that point where I'm still not there, as they say. But I never looked back. I actually liked New York. I loved Saratoga. And I didn't mind the winter racing. The purses were always good. And I'm still doing it here.
Still doing it, Mike. Still doing it. I was going to actually ask you that. You just said you don't mind the cold. I was going to ask you because I rode in Maryland, and I never rode in New York year-round.
Right.
But there were very many cold days, and I wish that I had gone down south to Florida. How do you do it year in, year out? Just dealing with that bitter cold there in Aqueduct.
You never get used to it. I mean, it's always cold, and you just need to dress appropriate. And like I said, the purses are always, you know, pretty much the same as they are in the summer. And I live a mile from Belmont. You during Aqueduct, you still do most of your morning work at Belmont.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a routine that I fell into. I had the kids and raised some kids and managed to have a pretty normal, you know, family life as far as jockeys go. I didn't move around. I had a chance to go to Florida, and it might have changed things for me, but I liked being home. I liked seeing the kids and raising the kids and, you know, taking them to school and then breathe a horse and then go take the kids to school and go back to the track. And you know, I was always occupied, so the cold was kind of, you know, if they canceled, they canceled. I did something at home and you know, made best of family life. So I guess I dealt with the cold just trying to live somewhat of a normal life, where some jockeys split their families up for the year, and you see in the Midwest, guys aren't, you know, they don't see their families for months at a time. And, you know, I sacrificed one thing for the other.
Well, and that would be so hard. Like you said, you had somewhat of a normal life compared to some of the gypsies out there, and I think that's awesome. That's awesome. And for your kids to grow up like that in one place too, that had to be so good. But how do you dress for those bitter cold days at Aqueduct? I mean, obviously you had to think about the weight when you're stepping on the scale. You can't have you know, some big coat on. But is there any secrets you have to surviving in the cold?
Just very, very, I kind of, you know, I rode before there were safety vests, and some people don't even bring that up, and they kind of added to the warmth thing. You know, I'll wear a regular turtleneck underneath the safety vest, and if it's really cold, I still have leather boots, which they don't even make anymore. You can't even find them. But they always helped with the cold. And to me, the most important thing were your hands. You found the gloves and anything like that that helped, that was the key to me, just keeping your hands warm. Because, you know, and listen, the easiest part was riding the race. You didn't get cold. You know, you didn't go down the backside and say, man, I'm freezing. You know, mm-hmm. You got other things to think about.
Right.
You know, it was galloping back after the race or those, you know, extra minutes before you went in the gate where you felt the cold. So, I mean, as long as the post parades were short and your hands are taken and feet are taken care of, it's not that bad. And, you know, you see around the country that jockeys wear masks from the dirt because sometimes the dirt hurts. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I've been blessed that I don't wear a mask, and I never really had a problem with the dirt hurting me. So that's, you know, another gift I was given that it doesn't bother me.
No, you're better than I am. I always had that face mask on, Mike. There's no way I was going
out. I couldn't wear one. I found it hard to wear, so I never did.
Yeah, I was a chicken when it came to the cold, for sure. Jockey Mike Lazzi joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike, we only have a couple minutes left. Like I told you
sure.
during the break, we could go on for 3 hours. But tell
right.
me, you know, you mentioned earlier on you and your brother John started riding about the same time. Your brother John, is he still riding today?
He's not. He's had finally... You know, he did have problems with the weight, and he's had some concussions and some injuries like that. So I think his last concussion or something, he did give it up, and he got a little big. So he had a little struggle throughout his career with that, and he moved around a lot, which is hard to do. And,
sure.
you know, he since was in Florida. He was still galloping horses at the time, and that was last year, so... He's been out of it for a little while.
Did you guys ever ride against each other?
We did, yeah. And it actually, you know, I didn't ride at Delaware Park, but if you ride in Maryland, you ship to Delaware on the dark days. And we actually rode some races there, and I was always on the better stock. You know, we have a photo somewhere where I was first and he was second. And that was a good experience. And it's funny you ask. Me and Lane actually got to ride one time this year at Aqueduct right before his fall. So
no, that was going to be my next question because when
beat you to it.
You did, because when we had him here on the show a couple months ago, I said Lane, did you ever ride against your dad? He said no, I haven't even breezed horses with him, nothing. I said well, you got to work on that. Come to find out, here we go. Well, how did it go? Who beat who?
He actually was third in a race, and I finished fifth. He was on the turf at Aqueduct, and it was fun. We got some pictures together, and he was in the room, and we had the same valet and so forth. It was pretty cool, but it kind of felt okay because Lane, like I said, he grew up in the jocks room. If he wasn't at school, he was with me in the jocks room. He never did like those other teenager things. He was a jockey even before he was a jockey.
That is awesome. Well, I hope you guys get to ride many more races together. We're wishing him the best of luck with his recovery. And, Mike, you too here. Saratoga's coming up. And wishing you all the luck in the world, Mike. Fortunately, we're about out of time now. But thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Very cool. My pleasure. And I'm glad that everybody listens and gets to hear some of our points of views. It's not the easiest job in the world, but... we all take it seriously. So everybody out there, just remember, we're always trying.
God bless you, Mike. Thank you so much. Take care. If you missed any portion of tonight's show or any of our other shows we bring to you here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, please check out our website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I am Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.